I want you to just picture something for a second. Think back to the very last time a piece of news, or maybe just a really juicy piece of gossip, passed through your office or your friend
Oh
group.
yeah, the classic water cooler game of telephone.
Right, exactly. You know exactly how it starts. Someone whispers this tiny, just hyper-specific detail by the coffee machine. Let's say it's I heard management is looking at the Q3 budget.
Simple enough.
Yeah, simple. But by the time that exact same piece of information makes its way across the floor through like three different Slack channels and finally into your ears at the end of the day, it's completely morphed.
It's never the same story.
No, suddenly the story isn't about the Q3 budget at all. It's the company is going bankrupt and they're replacing the entire accounting department with software by Friday.
Yeah, it escalates so quickly. And the funny thing is, it happens so reliably that we barely even question it anymore.
We just accept it.
Right, we usually just write it off as this, failure of communication. We treat it like the line went bad, or we just blame it on people not paying attention. But if we actually look at the cognitive mechanics underneath that distortion, we find out it isn't a glitch at all.
It's a feature. And this is exactly where we're going today for this deep dive. Did that story stay the same and people just misheard it? Or did it morph into something uniquely tailored to the specific anxieties, the expectations, and the prior beliefs of the exact people telling it?
It's definitely the latter.
Yeah. A new capstone paper by C.F. Dietz suggests that this distortion, this really aggressive morphing of information, is actually the fundamental operating system of human culture.
That's how we function.
Right. So our mission for this deep dive is to completely dismantle the idea that human beings are like biological copy machines. We aren't just taking in data and spitting out exact replicas.
You're doing something far stranger.
Much stranger. And Deitz's paper, which is called The Grammar of Culture, maps out the hidden cognitive architecture making all of this happen.
And I think it's important to note, this paper is actually the 20th and final installment in this massive series. Dietz has been writing on what they call the closure framework.
It's the grand finale.
Exactly. And what makes this final piece so powerful is how Dietz synthesizes their own framework with the life's work of Dan Sperber.
Sperber is he's kind of a legend in this space,
Oh,
right?
yeah, absolutely. He's this
Okay.
heavyweight French social and cognitive scientist who basically spent decades developing what he calls the epidemiology of representations.
We're going to get into that because that phrase is so cool.
It really is. But basically, Dietz takes Sperber's massive theories on how ideas spread and anchors them mechanically to the closure framework to explain how human minds process, systematically alter, and eventually stabilize culture over thousands of years.
So for you listening, understanding this framework gives you quite literally a cheat code for human behavior.
It really does explain so much.
It explains the mechanics of why certain ideas just go massively viral while others disappear instantly. It explains how, you and a coworker can sit in the exact same hour-long meeting, hear the exact same words, and walk away with two fundamentally contradictory understandings of what you just agreed to do.
I think we've all been there.
Oh, 100%. But to understand why this happens, we have to look at the empirical evidence of how the human brain actually handles foreign information, which takes us back about 100 years to a laboratory in Cambridge.
Right, the Bartlett experiment.
Yes.
So in the 1920s, a British psychologist named Frederick Bartlett ran this memory experiment that essentially laid the groundwork for modern cognitive psychology.
It's a classic.
It is. But what's fascinating is that Bartlett wasn't actually interested in testing how much people could remember.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't care about their rote memorization skills.
Right. It wasn't a spelling bee.
No, not at all. He wanted to see exactly what happens to an idea when it gets filtered through a mind that has absolutely no cultural framework for it.
So what did he do?
Well, he took a group of English university students. These are people thoroughly entrenched in early 20th century British culture, classical education, Victorian social norms, all of that.
Very proper, very structured.
Exactly. And he asked them to read a Native American folktale called The War of the Ghosts.
Okay, let's really set the scene on this for a second, because the contrast is what actually makes the experiment work.
Definitely.
This story was just entirely alien to these English students. If you grew up in 1920s Britain, you were primed on like Dickens, Austen, these very linear
You
narratives.
expect to set up a clear conflict.
Right, and a logical resolution based on material cause and effect. But The War of the Ghosts had none of that. It had a totally different narrative structure and these completely alien causal connections.
Yeah, the logic of the story was just fundamentally different.
In the story, warriors go into battle, but the narrative flow is just constantly interrupted by this supernatural logic. There's this one scene where a character falls sick, not because of a physical wound, but because a shadow passes over his canoe and this black substance comes out of his mouth.
Which is such a striking image.
It is. And in the context of the original Native American culture, this possesses an absolute internal logic. But to an English student in 1920, it is cognitive gibberish.
Right. So Bartlett had them read the story, and then he asked them to recall and write down the narrative at various intervals. So days later, weeks later, months later.
And if memory were just like a leaky bucket, you would expect random decay.
Right, exactly. You expect him to forget a name here or just drop a setting there, just random gaps.
Yeah.
But Bartlett found something entirely different. The students were systematically transforming the story.
They were actively editing it.
Yes. They gave it this complete cultural makeover. When the details didn't fit their British expectations of reality, they didn't just leave a blank space in their memory. They subconsciously rationalized the details.
So what happened to the shadow and the black substance?
That supernatural element was almost always dropped completely or changed into a natural, mundane event. A character didn't die from a ghost's shadow. They died because they caught a fever or they were struck by a physical arrow.
Wow.
Yeah. The narrative drifted really aggressively toward a conventional English story structure.
And the directionality of the change is the key here, right? It wasn't just random noise.
Not at all. With every single iteration, the story became shorter, but it also became increasingly coherent from a strictly English perspective.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it started making perfect sense to the British students who were retelling it, but it was completely stripped of its original Native American essence.
It's like a hyper-aggressive autocorrect on a smartphone.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Because, you know, when you try to type a slang word or a person's name that the phone's dictionary just doesn't recognize, it doesn't just misspell it. It actively forces the input to become a word it already knows.
Right. It overwrites it.
Exactly. And the phone isn't broken. It's doing exactly what it was programmed to do, make the input conform to its internal rules. But it begs the question, you know, were these English students just acting out of intense ethnocentrism? Were they intentionally rewriting the story to make themselves comfortable?
No, they weren't. And this is the cornerstone of Sperber's entire approach to cultural transmission. The students were actively trying their hardest to remember the story accurately.
So they weren't being malicious or lazy.
Not at all. They were instructed to give a faithful reproduction, and they honestly believed they were doing so. The transformation wasn't this conscious edit. It was an inevitable byproduct of their cognitive architecture.
Okay, we need to define that. When you say cognitive architecture in this context, what are the actual mechanics happening in the brain?
So it's the physical and structural scaffolding of your mind. It includes your deeply ingrained schemas, your neural pathways that dictate expectations of cause and effect, basically your entire prior knowledge base about how the physical world operates.
The blueprint of how you see reality.
Yes. So when these students tried to recall the War of the Ghosts, their brains literally could not find the necessary neural scaffolding to anchor the alien concepts.
Because a ghost's shadow causing a physical sickness just had no receptor in their worldview.
Exactly. So the brain did what it is biologically mandated to do. It reconstructed the story using the scaffolding it did possess.
So they weren't retrieving a memory from, like, a filing cabinet.
No, not at all.
They were walking into an empty room and rebuilding the memory from scratch every single time they were asked to tell the story, and they could only build with the materials they brought with them.
That is the exact mechanism. Memory, and by extension, cultural transmission, is not a retrieval process. It is an active reconstruction process.
That is a massive distinction.
It changes everything. Because if we take that single psychological phenomena, this inevitable biased reconstruction of foreign information, and we scale it up from a handful of Cambridge students to the level of millions of interacting humans over thousands of years, we arrive at a massive paradigm shift.
We have to confront the death of the meme.
Yes, we really do.
And this is where we completely dismantle the most popular theory of how things go viral. Because for decades, the dominant theory has treated ideas identically to biological genes.
Right, memetics.
Yeah, we owe this entirely to Richard Dawkins. Back in 1976, in his book, The Selfish Gene, Dawkins coined the word meme. He proposed memetics, which is the idea that cultural units, whether that's, you know, a catchy tune, a fashion trend, a slang word, or just a method for building a clay pot copy themselves from one human mind to another, in the exact same way that genetic information copies itself from cell to cell via DNA.
Dawkins proposed that memes are literal replicators. But if you look at evolutionary biology, genetic replication works because DNA relies on incredibly complex, high-fidelity molecular machinery.
Right, it's a physical process.
Exactly. You have enzymes like DNA polymerases, you have built-in error-checking and proofreading mechanisms.
Yeah.
The system was designed by billions of years of evolution to make near-exact copies of a blueprint.
And Dawkins and the whole field of memetics that followed, they just assumed culture had a similar, albeit invisible, mechanism.
Which Dan Sperber looks at and completely rejects.
He just throws it out.
He says the analogy between cultural transmission and genetic replication isn't just slightly off, it is fundamentally mechanically flawed. There is no cultural polymerase. There is no biological mechanism ensuring high-fidelity copying of a thought from one brain to another.
Because culture is not a copying process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If I teach you how to tie a specific knot, I am not downloading the neural pattern of knot tying from my brain and uploading it to yours.
Right. We don't have Bluetooth for brains yet.
No, we don't. I am moving my hands. I am creating a visual stimulus in your environment.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain has to take in that visual data, interpret my intentions, analyze the physics of the rope, and then physically build a brand new neural pathway that coordinates your own motor functions to achieve a similar result.
You are reconstructing the skill, not replicating it.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wait, let me push back on this a little bit. Because
yeah.
If I send a cat meme on my phone, I tap a picture, I hit copy link, and I paste it into a group chat. The literal hardware of the phones duplicates the exact arrangement of pixels flawlessly.
Sure.
So how does Sperber account for the fact that we do, objectively, have mechanisms for perfect replication now? We literally use the word meme every day for this.
Well, the digital hardware replicates the pixels, yes.
Right.
But digital files are not culture until they are processed by a human mind. The mistake is confusing the medium of transmission with the cognitive representation itself.
Okay, wait, walk me through that. If the phone copies the pixels perfectly, what is my friend's brain actually doing when they look at the screen?
Their brain is being forced to build a brand new emotional and conceptual meaning from scratch.
Even for just a picture of a cat.
Even for a picture of a cat. When you looked at that cat picture and decided to send it, you didn't just see a cat. Your brain instantly recruited this massive web of context. You understood the irony of the caption. You recognized the specific internet subculture references. You factored in the social dynamics of your specific group chat.
And I had a specific emotional intent, like I wanted to make my friends laugh.
Exactly. The meaning of that meme was a bespoke, transient neural state generated by your specific mind in that exact millisecond.
And I can't text a neural state.
No, you cannot. You can only text the pixels. When your friend opens the message, their phone displays the identical image. But their brain has to reconstruct the meaning. And their cognitive architecture is different.
Because they're a different person with a different day.
Right. Maybe they're from a different generation and they don't understand the irony.
Huh?
Or maybe they're highly stressed today, so their brain is primed to interpret ambiguous stimuli negatively, and they reconstruct the meaning as you mocking them for being lazy like the cat.
Oh, wow. I've definitely had texts misinterpreted like that.
We all have.
Yeah.
And even if they get the joke perfectly, they are building that humor using their own neural scaffolding. They did not download your thought.
This shifts the entire foundation of how we study society.
It really does.
Because the replicator model, the Dawkins model, asks a very specific question. It asks, what makes this specific meme so fit, so contagious, that it survives and copies itself across a population? It treats the idea like a virus and the human mind like a passive petri dish.
But once you accept that the mind isn't a passive petri dish, but rather this aggressive reconstructing machine with its own built-in biases, you have to ask a much deeper question.
Right. If every single mind is actively rebuilding and altering ideas rather than copying them, why isn't human culture just a chaotic, swirling mess of random noise?
Exactly. If we're constantly morphing information like the students reading The War of the Ghosts, why do we ever agree on anything? How do we have stable languages or enduring religious institutions or these massive cohesive societies?
So the question isn't how do things copy perfectly. The question is, What are the biological and cognitive biases in our shared brains that force us all to reconstruct things in the exact same way?
And that leads us to the absolute core of Sperber's framework, which is the epidemiology of representations.
Okay, let's unpack that.
Sperber argues that we should study the spread of culture the same way epidemiologists study the spread of a disease, but with a crucial distinction regarding causality.
Walk me through the epidemiological causality here.
So an epidemiologist tracks a physical chain. Person A has a virus in their respiratory tract. They cough, expelling the physical virus into the air. Person B inhales the exact same physical virus, and it begins replicating in their cells.
Right, standard biology.
But Sperber tracks causal chains of representations. A mental representation in mind A causes a physical behavior. So they speak a sentence, they paint a canvas, they build a tool. That behavior alters the physical environment.
Okay, I'm with you.
Mind B encounters that altered environment, and that sensory input triggers mind B to construct a completely new mental representation.
So it's causally linked, but it's not a clone.
Exactly.
It's as if person A have a cold, coughs on person B, and person B's immune system reacts to the cough by spontaneously generating the flu. A transmission of influence happened, but the final state is dictated entirely by the receiving host's internal system, not the sender's.
That is a perfect way to look at it. The receiver's biology dictates the outcome. And because human brains share a vast amount of evolutionary biology and cognitive architecture, the resulting diseases, the reconstructed representations, are not random.
They tend to cluster.
Yes. And this introduces Sperber's most powerful concept, cultural attractors.
This concept of cultural attractors, it feels like the skeleton key for this entire paper.
It really is the anchor of the whole theory.
An attractor is defined as a point or, a specific region in the space of possible representations toward which individual reconstructions naturally tend to converge over time.
They are statistical regularities. It is vital here to break the habit of thinking about culture platonically.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning, there is no perfect canonical version of a myth or a concept stored in some ethereal vault that everyone is trying to copy. A cultural attractor is simply a statistical cluster. It's the mathematical result of millions of human brains, all possessing similar biological biases, reconstructing information, and landing in roughly the same conceptual territory.
The paper uses the example of color lexicons, which I think grounds this perfectly in biology. How do different cultures name colors?
So if you look at the raw physics of light, the color spectrum is this continuous smooth gradient of electromagnetic wavelengths. In objective physical reality, there are no hard borders between red, orange, yellow, green, and blue.
It just seamlessly shifts.
Right. Therefore, theoretically, human cultures could carve up that spectrum linguistically in infinite, completely arbitrary ways. You could have a culture that uses one single word for everything from ultraviolet to yellowish green, and a second word for all the rest.
But when linguists and anthropologists study languages globally, they don't see arbitrary divisions like that.
No, they don't.
Cultures do carve up the spectrum differently, like some have three basic color terms, some have 12, but they do not carve it randomly. The color categories across almost all human languages systematically cluster around very specific, predictable regions of the physical spectrum.
And the reason for this convergence isn't because of some ancient cultural exchange. It's because of shared biological architecture.
The actual biology of the eye.
Yes. The human visual system, the specific rods and cones in our retinas and our neurobiological color memory systems, are actually evolved to process certain wavelengths of light more easily than others.
So certain colors are literally easier to think about.
Exactly. Certain clusters of wavelengths are just more cognitively salient to a human animal. So over hundreds of generations, as people interact, point to objects, and constantly reconstruct what the other person means by a sound, the vocabulary systematically gravitates toward those biologically salient regions.
The biology creates a gravitational pull on the language.
It does. It pulls it in.
It's exactly like a skateboard half pipe.
Oh, I love this analogy.
Yeah, think about the physics of a half pipe. You can drop a skateboard into that ramp from literally anywhere along the top edge. You can throw it in sideways, you can drop it from the left, from the right, but no matter where that skateboard enters the system, gravity and the physical curved shape of the ramp dictate its path.
Just going to roll back and forth, losing momentum.
And it will eventually, inevitably, settle at the exact same spot at the very bottom center of the ramp.
And the bottom of the half pipe is the cultural attractor.
Right. The skateboard is the idea or the representation being passed around in society, and the physical shape of the wood and metal ramp itself. That is our shared cognitive architecture. The biology of our brains provides the slope.
It's a brilliant way to visualize it because it scales up infinitely. If you take the logic of that half pipe and apply it to concepts far more complex than just the color red, the grand tapestry of human history starts to look very different.
It really does.
It explains why certain narrative structures, like the hero's journey, or specific magical beliefs, or concepts of hierarchical gods and spirits, pop up completely independently in isolated cultures across the globe.
We used to look at pyramids in Egypt and pyramids in Mesoamerica and assume, oh, there must have been some ancient lost civilization that carried the blueprints across the ocean.
We assumed a perfect copying mechanism.
Right.
But the epidemiology of representations tells us a different story. It's because human brains, dealing with similar universal human experiences, you know, the cycle of birth and death, the threat of predators, the necessity of social hierarchy, the physics of stacking heavy rocks, they all have similar cognitive architectures.
So when isolated populations try to make sense of the world, they independently reconstruct information.
And that information rolls down the neurological ramp toward the exact same cognitive gravity wells. The long-term stability of a culture isn't this miracle of perfect replication. It is the inevitable statistical result of billions of brains all sloping toward the same center.
Okay, so that covers the macro. That explains how a mythology stabilizes over 5,000 years. But I want to zoom all the way in.
Let's do it.
Just you and me having this conversation right now. How does this aggressive reconstruction happen in real time in the span of like milliseconds during a normal conversation?
To understand the micromechanics of conversation, Dietz points us to relevance theory, which was developed by Dan Sperber alongside Deirdre Wilson.
And to see why relevance theory is so revolutionary, we first have to look at the traditional model it overthrew, right?
Definitely. For decades, the foundational model of communication in linguistics and engineering was the Shannon Weaver model.
The coding-decoding model. Basically, the idea that human language works like a pair of walkie-talkies.
Precisely. In the Shannon Weaver model, communication is mechanical translation. I have a specific thought in my mind. I encode that thought into a standardized set of symbols, words, and grammar.
Then you transmit those words through the air as physical sound waves.
Your ear captures the sound waves, your brain processes the vocabulary, and you decode the message perfectly, recovering my exact original thought.
And communication is deemed successful if the decoded message perfectly matches the encoded message.
Right. It sounds incredibly logical, especially since that's exactly how computer networks operate. But Sperber and Wilson argue this is a complete fiction when applied to human beings.
They just completely dismantled it.
They did. They argue that human communication is not coding and decoding. It is an entirely different process called ostensive inferential communication.
Ostensive and inferential. Let's break those down because they are heavy words for something we do intuitively every single second.
Sure. An ostensive act is simply a behavior designed to draw someone's attention and make it clear that you are trying to communicate. It doesn't even have to be language.
What's an example of that?
So if we are at a loud party and I catch your eye, clear my throat, and emphatically point at my wristwatch, that is an ostensive act. I haven't encoded a literal syntactic sentence like, I believe we have overstayed our welcome and it is time to depart.
No, you just tapped your wrist.
I have merely performed an action to make it mutually manifest that I want you to pay attention to the time.
And the inferential part is what happens inside my brain. I have to guess what you mean by the pointing.
You do have to guess, but it is a highly structured, biologically driven guesswork. You infer my intended meaning based on your massive web of contextual knowledge. And the engine that drives this rapid-fire inference is what Sperber and Wilson call the optimization criterion, or, more simply, relevance.
The paper defines relevance in a very specific, almost mathematical way. It says that when a hearer is confronted with an ostensive act, their brain automatically searches for the interpretation that yields the greatest cognitive effect for the least processing effort.
We have to look at the biology here. The human brain is an incredibly expensive organ. It makes up about 2% of your body weight, but consumes like 20% of your daily caloric energy.
It's an energy hog.
Massive. Because it is so metabolically expensive, evolution has designed neurons to be ruthlessly efficient. Your brain is a cognitive miser. It wants to spend as little energy as possible. That is processing effort.
Okay.
At the same time, the brain's job is to keep you alive by maintaining an accurate model of the world. An update to that model is a cognitive effect.
So when you point at the watch at the party, my brain could theoretically infer a million different things.
Oh, totally.
It could infer that you just bought a new watch and want me to admire the craftsmanship. It can infer that you want me to know what time it is so I can synchronize my own watch. Or it could infer that you are bored and want to leave.
And your brain evaluates those options in milliseconds based on the optimization criterion. Inferring that I want you to admire the craftsmanship might require a lot of processing effort. You'd have to remember, if I like watches, analyze the brand, consider the lighting in the room.
Too much work.
Way too much work. But given our shared context, say, we discussed earlier that we had an early morning meeting tomorrow and the party's dying down anyway. Inferring that my gesture means we need to leave right now creates a massive update to your behavioral worldview.
Meaning we need to go get our coats.
Exactly. Yeah. And it does this for almost zero processing effort. The context makes that specific inference highly relevant, so your brain just stops searching and accepts it as the meaning.
But if what you're saying is true, and our brains are just lazily optimizing for whatever is easiest to process in the moment, how on earth do humans ever accomplish complex, high-friction tasks?
It's a great question.
Like, society should have collapsed into a chaotic mess of misunderstandings. If I'm never actually receiving your exact thought, but just aggressively inferring whatever is mathematically easiest for my neurons, how do we successfully build airplanes or write legal contracts or even just order a coffee?
It's the ultimate paradox of human existence, and relevance theory answers it beautifully. Communication is chaotic. It is always an approximation. We never truly achieve perfect mind building.
We're just guessing.
Pretty much. When you walk into a cafe and order a coffee, the barista does not have direct access to your internal neural state. But society functions because we share enough biological cognitive architecture and we share enough standardized cultural context that our approximations overlap just enough to be practically useful.
So you say large dark roast, the barista infers give this person 16 ounces of hot bean water in exchange for currency?
Exactly. Because in the highly constrained context of a coffee shop, that is the interpretation that yields the greatest cognitive effect for the least processing effort.
The barista isn't going to infer you are speaking in a metaphor about the darkness of the human soul, because that requires way too much effort.
Precisely. But here is the massive, slightly terrifying implication hidden inside relevance theory.
Okay, I'm ready.
The brain optimizes for relevance. It does not optimize for truth. Maximum relevance does not mean maximum fidelity to reality.
Wow, that is a staggering point. The easiest thing to process isn't always what's actually happening.
Not at all. Your brain reconstructs what is easy and what is immediately useful to your survival or your social standing in that specific moment. If I tell you a complex, nuanced story about a conflict I had at work where I was partially at fault, your brain is going to reconstruct the elements of that story that fit your existing schemas.
So if I already have a prior opinion that your boss is a jerk?
Your brain will amplify the details that confirm that bias and will unconsciously discard the nuances of my own culpability, because processing the cognitive dissonance of my failure requires too much effort. You optimize for the easiest narrative.
Which is the exact same mechanism that drove the Bartlett experiment.
Yes.
When the British students read The War of the Ghosts, the supernatural elements required massive processing effort to integrate into a Victorian materialistic worldview. It caused intense cognitive friction.
So their brains simply took the path of least resistance.
They inferred a natural explanation instead. It was more relevant to their existing worldview, even though it was entirely objectively inaccurate to the source material.
You've connected the micro to the macro perfectly. The exact same neural efficiency mechanism that makes you misunderstand a text message from your partner is the mechanism that slowly grinds down a complex foreign folktale into a simplified cultural trope over decades.
That is just incredible.
And this is actually the perfect moment to introduce C.F. Dietz's primary contribution to all of this. Sperber mapped out that this happens, and relevance theory explains the energetic economy of it. But Dietz's closure framework provides the literal structural engine.
Right. It explains the physical shape of the boundary that forces these transformations. Okay, so relevance theory explains the path of least resistance. The closure framework explains what is physically building the walls of that path. Dietz argues that every human mind is a finite cognitive closure. What exactly constitutes a closure in this context?
So a closure is a bounded system that stabilizes its internal content by drawing hard distinctions and establishing strict identity criteria. A really good way to think about it is a legal system.
Okay, A legal system.
A nation's legal code is a type of closure. It has incredibly specific definitions or identity criteria for what constitutes a contract or a felony or a citizen. When a totally unprecedented human interaction occurs out in the real world and is brought before a judge, the judge cannot process the raw, infinite complexity of human emotion and context.
They have to use the law.
Right. The judge has to process the event using the existing laws, the existing identity criteria. The legal system is closed in that it can only constitute reality using its own internal grammar. It forces the chaotic real-world event into its pre-existing boxes.
I want to try an analogy here to see if I'm grasping the individual cognitive level. It feels like translating a massive, high-resolution, full-color photograph into a Lego set.
Oh, I like that. Let's explore the mechanics of that.
Okay, imagine your specific mind, your cognitive closure, is a Lego set. Because you are finite, you only possess certain bricks. You have a bin of 2x4 red bricks, some 1x1 blue bricks, and, I don't know, a few specialized window pieces.
Those bricks are your identity criteria.
Right. They are the concepts and categories you've accumulated over your life. Now, objective reality, or a story told by a friend, or a complex piece of political news comes to you. That input is the high-resolution photograph. It has millions of pixels, infinite gradients of color, perfect smooth curves.
So when that photograph enters your mind, your closure is tasked with rebuilding it.
But it cannot use pixels. It can only rebuild the image using the rigid plastic bricks it actually possesses in the bin.
That analogy does a lot of heavy lifting. Because if the photograph happens to be a picture of, say, an 8-bit blocky video game character, it aligns perfectly with your existing Lego bricks.
Your closure can rebuild it with almost zero transformation. The processing effort is incredibly low.
Right. But what happens if the photograph is a picture of a human face?
It has smooth gradients of shadow, soft curves around the eyes, thousands of micro-expressions.
But you still have to build it with square, primary-colored Lego bricks.
Exactly. The resulting Lego model you construct in your mind is going to look profoundly different from the smooth photograph. You have forced a massive transformation on the information because the input poorly fit your existing identity criteria.
And this brings us to the most crucial mechanical question in Dietz's framework. When you build that blocky Lego face, what happens to the smooth curves and the exact shades of shadow that you couldn't recreate with your blocks?
They just get left out. They evaporate.
Well, in Dietz's terminology, those left out pieces do not evaporate. They become something called remainder.
Remainder?
Yes. Every single time a finite closure interacts with an infinite reality, it generates remainder. It is the surplus data, the friction, the part of the input that the closure simply cannot constitute or understand using its current rules.
Remainder. It's like the cognitive exhaust pipe.
Exactly. But Dietz is adamant in the paper that remainder isn't just noise, and it isn't a failure of the system.
It's the most important part, right?
It is the most important part of the system. Dietz argues that remainder is structural proof that the grammar of our mind is finite. It is the boundary pushing back. And this is where Dietz pulls off a phenomenal synthesis of Sperber's work. Remember Sperber's cultural attractors?
Yeah.
The gravity wells that draw ideas together.
Yes, the bottom of the half pipe.
Dietz argues that a cultural attractor is simply the shared identity criteria of a whole population of closures.
Oh, wow. So a cultural attractor is just an entire society subconsciously realizing, hey, biologically and culturally, we all seem to have a massive surplus of 2x4 red Lego bricks. It takes the least processing effort for all of us if we just agree to build our society's concepts out of those specific bricks.
Yes, that's exactly it. The shared bricks create the attractor. And yeah. Relevance is simply the optimization algorithm your closure uses to decide which bricks to reach for first.
That's amazing.
But the true genius of Dietz's framework is what happens with the remainder. When you constantly encounter reality that generates massive amounts of remainder, when the world keeps pressing back against your simplistic, relevance-driven, blocky Lego reconstructions, that remainder builds up.
It creates pressure.
Structural pressure. And eventually, that pressure reaches a critical mass that forces a society or an individual to undergo a paradigm shift. They are forced to update their worldview. They had to literally invent a new shape of Lego brick to handle the complexity.
The friction of what we cannot understand is the literal engine that drives us to learn and evolve. If we perfectly replicated everything without remainder, we would be entirely stagnant.
We would never change.
Okay, we have built this grand unified theory of cognitive closure. Now I want to pan the camera all the way back and look at the entire academic tapestry Dietz is weaving. Because in this final paper, Dietz doesn't just look at Sperber and the closure framework in a vacuum.
No, they really tie it all together.
They use it as a keystone to bridge the gap between several other major scientific thinkers covered in the previous 19 papers of the series. We are looking at three distinct scales of human culture: the micro, the macro, and the epistemological.
Yes, Dietz connects Sperber's epidemiology of representations to the specific works of Lyra Boroditsky, Eva Jablonga, and Helen Longino. By doing so, Dietz creates a unified theory of human knowledge. Let's start at the micro level, with the individual cognitive closure, which is the domain of Lyra Boroditsky.
Boroditsky is famous for her work on linguistic relativity, right?
Right. She studies how the specific vocabulary and grammar of the language you speak literally physically shapes your cognitive abilities.
She provides the empirical proof that different cultures have different Lego bricks.
Exactly. Her most famous research involves the Russian language's treatment of the color blue.
Oh, this is a great example.
In English, we have a single foundational category for the color blue. We can add adjectives. We can say light blue or dark blue. But neurologically, it is all grouped within the same basic conceptual bucket.
But the Russian language forces a hard distinction.
Yes. Russian has two entirely distinct basic lexical categories: Sinny for dark blue and Goloboy for light blue. To a native Russian speaker, Sinny and Goloboy are as fundamentally different and distinct as the concepts of red and pink are to an English speaker.
Because you would never call pink light red in a casual conversation, it is its own category.
Exactly.
So to bring it back to our analogy, a Russian speaker's cognitive closure literally possesses a blue Lego brick that an English speaker's closure does not have.
And Boroditsky proved that this isn't just a quirk of vocabulary. It alters physical processing speed.
Wait, really?
Yes. In laboratory experiments, Russian speakers are measurably faster at visually distinguishing between two shades of blue if those shades happen to cross that Sinny-Goloboy boundary. Because their linguistic grammar established a hard identity criterion in their cognitive closure, their brains process the visual input differently. Their closure is shaped by their language.
That is wild. So Boroditsky maps the exact boundaries of a single individual mind. That's the micro. Now we zoom out to the extreme macro evolutionary timescale, which Dietz connects to the work of Eva Jablonka.
Right. Jablonka focuses on how massive amounts of complex information are passed across geological timescales. In evolutionary biology, she wrote about the four dimensions of evolution, basically pushing back against the idea that DNA is the only thing we inherit.
Because we also inherit culture.
Exactly. She highlights the symbolic inheritance system, which is language, art, and culture. She examines how human beings uniquely manage to pass down wildly complex behavioral routines and symbolic closures from one generation to the next, maintaining stability over thousands of years, despite the fact that every single brain dies.
And here is where Dietz places Dan Sperber as the ultimate connective tissue. Sperber is the bridge between Boroditsky's micromind and Jablonka's macro history.
Exactly. Boroditsky shows us how one single mind builds its Lego models. Jablonka shows us that entire cities made of Lego somehow survive and maintain their shape over millennia. And Sperber explains how that happens without a biological copying mechanism.
He explains how a massive population of individual closures, like the ones Boroditsky studies, constantly interacting, generating behaviors, and reconstructing representations, naturally converge on shared cultural attractors.
And the statistical clustering of attractors is what produces the long-term cultural stability that Jablonka observes in the evolutionary record.
Because they all share similar biological architecture, and they are all optimizing for relevance, their individual reconstructions repeatedly roll down the same cognitive half-pipe.
Exactly. The stability isn't in the transmission. The stability is in the shared shape of the ramp.
That is incredibly elegant. But Dietz takes it one step further and applies this to the concept of absolute truth in science, bringing in Helen Longino.
Yes, Longino operates in the realm of epistemology, the philosophical study of how we acquire knowledge and what justifies our belief that something is true or objective. Longino applies these exact same dynamics of closures and attractors to scientific communities.
Because we tend to think of science as this perfectly objective, sterile process. We think of scientists as unbiased robots discovering capital T truth.
But Longino argues that a scientific community is still just a population of human closures. They are still biological creatures optimizing for relevance and processing input through identity criteria. The difference is that a scientific community is organized by highly specialized, artificially constructed shared structures. The scientific method, the peer review process, the requirement for reproducible data. These are intentionally designed, rigid constraints placed on the cognitive halfpipe.
So scientific objectivity isn't achieved by a single genius perceiving the raw truth of the universe. It is achieved socially.
Exactly. Scientific stability, whether that's the paradigm of Newtonian physics or the later shift to quantum mechanics, is achieved the exact same way cultural stability is achieved. It happens through the convergence of individual reconstructions toward shared attractors. But in this case, the attractors are heavily policed by the rigorous identity criteria of the scientific community.
So when an anomaly in physics generates too much remainder,
when the old Newtonian Lego blocks can no longer map the high-resolution photograph of the quantum universe, the pressure builds until the scientific community is forced to adopt a new paradigm. They invent quantum Legos.
Wow. When you look at the full synthesis of Dietz's 20-part series, it completely reframes human history.
It really does.
We are not passing down a stagnant, dusty encyclopedia of objective knowledge from generation to generation. That is a dead replicator model. What we are actually passing down is a grammar. We are inheriting a set of instructions, a set of flexible identity criteria on how to actively build, tear down, and rebuild reality together in real time every single time we speak to each other.
That is the ultimate thesis of the grammar of culture. The culture itself is not what is mechanically copied. The culture is what a population of finite, limited, biased cognitive closures can stably contain and constitute again and again from the same shared biological and social ground.
We have covered a staggering amount of conceptual ground today. Let's trace the arc one last time for everyone listening. We started in the 1920s with Bartlett's memory experiments, watching British students systematically rewrite a Native American folktale to fit their own cognitive scaffolding,
which gave us the empirical proof.
Right. The proof that led us to confront the death of the meme, realizing that human brains do not replicate ideas like DNA. We relentlessly reconstruct them. We explored how those individual reconstructions naturally gravitate toward cultural attractors, like a skateboard settling at the bottom of a half pipe.
Guided by relevance theory.
Yes, guided by our brain's constant metabolically desperate search for the most worldview updating information for the least amount of effort. And finally, Dietz's closure framework showed us the physical mechanics behind it all. Our minds are Lego sets, translating the infinite complexity of reality into the finite bricks we possess, leaving behind a remainder of friction that ultimately forces our societies to evolve.
It's a huge shift in perspective. And if there's one deeply practical takeaway you can pull from this dense academic framework and apply to your life immediately, it is to profoundly change how you react to your next miscommunication.
Oh, this is so important.
Because when someone fundamentally misunderstands you, whether it's your partner, your boss, or a stranger on the internet, your biological first instinct is frustration. You assume malice or stupidity. You think, they aren't listening, or they failed to decode my very clear message.
You assume the walkie-talkie is broken or that they turned it off on purpose.
But knowing what you know now about the grammar of culture, try to view that friction differently. They are not failing to decode you. Their unique cognitive closure is simply reconstructing your ostensive act based on their own internal logic of relevance. They possess a different set of Lego bricks than you do.
That makes a lot of sense.
The goal of a successful human relationship or a successful society isn't to force the other person to use your bricks. The goal is to understand the shape of the closure that produced their reconstruction.
That is an incredibly empathetic, empowering way to navigate the world. But having built this beautiful, stable framework of human interaction, I think we have to look at the massive storm on the horizon.
I wouldn't expect this to end on a comfortable note.
Well, we have spent this entire deep dive establishing that cultural stability relies entirely on the shared cognitive architecture of human minds. We share biology, we share evolutionary history, our retinas process light the same way, and our neurons optimize for the same metabolic efficiency.
Right, we share the slope.
Because we share that slope, our attractors are relatively stable. But here is the provocative final thought for you to chew on. What happens to the grammar of human culture right now, in this exact historical moment, as we introduce artificial intelligence into the network?
It changes the fundamental physics of the system.
Think about the mechanics we just laid out. An AI model, a massive neural network generating text and art, is an entirely alien closure. It does not have human biology. It does not have metabolic processing limits. It runs on gigawatts of electricity.
Its optimization criteria are totally different than ours.
It does not possess the evolutionary cognitive gravity that causes humans to naturally simplify things. As AI begins generating, reconstructing, and transmitting representations by the billions, acting as highly active nodes in our cultural network, what happens to the halfpipe? Will the presence of this alien closure bend our cultural attractors in ways the human mind has never experienced before?
If culture is strictly defined as the statistical distribution of how minds reconstruct information, and suddenly half of the minds doing the reconstructing in our society are not human, the shape of the ramp fundamentally warps.
The gravity changes, and suddenly that morphing office rumor about the Q3 budget isn't just changing to fit human anxieties anymore. It is morphing to fit a cognitive architecture we don't even fully understand yet. So the next time you hear a story passed on the grapevine or read a viral piece of news on your feed, you have to ask yourself a much more complicated question. Who or what reconstructed this before it got to me?